A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese, oceans and sunsets. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors looking for a custodian who can help them go further. With all the wealth services, technology, and support an RIA firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabious. Find your match and learn why custody is just the beginning at schwabious.com.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome back. So today we're doing a really critical deep dive. Think of it as a postmortem sequel on the recent elections.
Right.
But we're not really looking at the big national headlines you've already heard.
No.
We want to drill down into those micro signals maybe the media missed. Things like unexpected local results, simmering cultural stuff.
Exactly. Things pointing towards 2026, maybe even deeper shifts.
Yeah.
And we've pulled together a really interesting mix of sources for you. It's got internal analysis on how the administration reacted privately to, well, taking a beating.
Okay.
Surprising results. Georgia, Mississippi, a deep dive into that key Pennsylvania county, Bucks.
Ah, the bellwether.
Mm-hmm. And then this other quite profound clash brewing between the administration's policies and, well, the Catholic Church.
Okay, so quite a range. So for you, the listener, the mission today is connecting these seemingly scattered dots.
Right. What does it all mean?
What's the picture they paint about the political climate right now? And, you know, what are the practical signs that might actually matter going forward?
Let's jump in.
Okay, let's start at the top. National noise, internal party stuff.
Sounds good.
So leading up to the vote, there was a lot of chatter, maybe even some fear about the DOJ sending election monitors, right?
Oh, yeah, big story.
To places like California, New Jersey.
Yeah.
Places you wouldn't necessarily expect. And the fear was, is this a trial run? A dry run for 2026 voter intimidation?
It definitely dominated the pre-election coverage. But according to sources who were actually there on the ground, it was, well, pretty much a non-event.
Really?
Yeah, reporters were out looking for these monitors, couldn't find them. We heard like maybe two spotted in all of Fresno County, that kind of thing.
Just two?
Yeah. And when they were found, they weren't career folks. They were political appointees, some described as, you know, hardcore Megier loyalists.
Okay, so what's the read on that? Our material seems to have two sort of competing theories on why it fizzled.
Right. One idea is maybe the administration just couldn't find enough qualified people or maybe enough willing people to do this kind of overtly political thing.
That makes sense. What's the other interpretation?
Well, the other and maybe more concerning analysis is that it wasn't really about immediate intimidation, not this time.
Okay.
It might have been more like an intelligence gathering operation. Sending high-level political types lets them test the waters, see how the DOJ machinery reacts, how local officials push back.
So collecting intel.
Exactly. Gathering intel for a potentially bigger, maybe more legally focused or bureaucratic challenge in 2026. Less about boots on the ground, more about, you know, maneuvering behind the scenes.
That's, yeah, that's a more chilling thought than just not finding enough people.
Mm-hmm.
And related to that, some sources told us, watch out for post-election fraud claims being used as a pretext.
Mm.
But we haven't really seen a flood of those either, have we?
No, that's right. It seems like right now, anyway, it's harder to sell those big fraud narratives when the wins are pretty decisive.
The margins matter.
Yeah, the claims seem to get more traction when it's really close, or when it's specifically about flipping a Trump loss into a supposed win. So that relative quiet, maybe a small positive sign for now.
Okay, let's shift to the president's private reactions.
Yeah.
Because whatever's being said publicly, our sources say he knows the GOP took a hit.
Oh, he knows.
Reports mention, let's say, significant temper tantrums aimed at fellow Republicans.
Yeah.
Speaker Mike Johnson, Lindsey Graham specifically named.
Yeah, the blame game is definitely on. And it's strategic, right? He's reportedly pointing the finger squarely at the shutdown debacle and, interestingly, at Senate Republicans.
Saying they weren't loyal enough.
Pretty much. Not loyal enough, didn't fight hard enough. And he apparently used this moment, the losses, as leverage. Tried to push Senate Republicans privately to just abolish the filibuster now.
Wow. How did that go over?
Stony. Yeah. Silence. That's the report.
Stony silence.
And that silence, that's the real tell here, I think. He's testing his influence, trying to tie the election losses to this longstanding Senate rule.
And getting nothing back.
Exactly. It suggests his power to just dictate procedure to Senate leadership. It's waning. That reduces his leverage quite a bit heading into the next cycle.
Okay, staying with Congress, but moving to the House.
Yeah.
There's another fascinating little detail showing how election losses have immediate consequences. We're talking about the discharge petition math.
Right. The magic number, 218 signatures needed to force a vote on something the speaker doesn't want on the floor.
Yeah.
The timing here is just brutal for the Democrats trying to use it. You've got Rep. Spanberger leaving by January 17th, Rep. Sherrill by the 20th. Both heading off to be governors.
So that's two signatures gone.
Instantly drops the total. Now, Rep-elect Adelita Grijalva comes in, but that only brings it back up one, still short of 218.
Meaning that threat, that tool to bypass the speaker.
It's off the table.
No.
For months, probably, until those seats are filled in special elections. Mm. It gives the speaker a lot more breathing room. A small detail, but strategically huge.
Absolutely huge. Okay, let's pivot now.
Yep.
State level, because some of the maybe the most interesting signals for 2026 weren't in D.C. at all.
Agreed.
Let's start in Georgia. There was a special election for two seats on the Public Service Commission, the PSC. Not usually headline news.
No, but this is a really big deal when totally under the radar for most people. The PSC, remember, sets utility rates, oversees energy projects, big climate policy implications now.
Okay. And what happened?
Democrats flipped two seats. Alicia Johnson and Peter Hubbard won. And get this, turnout was huge, over 1.4 million votes cast.
Wow. So why is that, like, historic?
Well, first, it's the first time a Democrat won any seat on the Georgia PSC in 25 years.
A quarter century.
Yeah. And bigger picture. It's the first time the Democrats have won any statewide constitutional office there since 2006.
Okay, that is significant.
And Governor Kemp, the Republican governor, he put a lot of political muscle into this race for the Republicans who lost. So this wasn't just a fluke. It feels like a real message. When the party in power loses control over, you know, electricity bills and things like that.
That's a loud canary.
Exactly. A very loud canary in the coal mine.
Okay, let's head over to Mississippi. Democrats picked up three state Senate seats there. Sounds small, maybe.
Doesn't sound like much, but the impact is big. It meant the GOP lost its supermajority in the state Senate.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay, so that changes the dynamic.
Immediately. Makes it much harder for the majority to just ram through, let's say, the more controversial, highly partisan stuff. That veto-proof edge, gone.
And the reaction from the state GOP chair, Mike Hurst, was pretty defensive.
Yeah, blaming gerrymandered districts drawn by an unelected court, blaming federal statutes weaponized by interest groups. Mm. You know, the usual suspects.
But notably, not just blaming national politics.
Right. He went straight for the map drawers and the courts, which kind of shows the pressure they're feeling right there at the state level.
Interesting. And one more state note. Virginia, Elteen Gavelekt Ghazala Hashmi, a historic win.
Absolutely. First Muslim, first Asian American to hold statewide office in Virginia's history.
Which is significant in itself.
But zooming out even further, she's the first Muslim woman to win statewide office anywhere in the United States. Ever.
Why?
So this isn't just one election, right? It speaks to these larger demographic shifts, changing patterns of political engagement. It's reshaping the map, especially in places like Virginia that are growing and changing fast.
All right, let's really drill down now into one specific place. Bucks County, Pennsylvania. PA-01. We keep calling it critical, a bellwether. Why?
Well, it's that classic suburban swing county. It was pretty reliably Democratic for a long time. Then Trump narrowly won it in 2024.
Which was the first time a Republican presidential candidate had won Bucks since, what, the 80s?
Exactly. So yeah. It really is on that knife's edge. And then in these recent local elections, Total reversal.
What happened locally?
Local Democrats just swept the board. Every single countywide office. And not by small margins, like around 10 points each.
10 points, that's decisive.
Yeah, the biggest margin they've had in a decade. They flipped the DA's office, flipped the county sheriff role. That one went to an Army reservist named Danny Ciesler.
And Ciesler's campaign, the strategy there, seems pretty instructive for Democrats trying to win in these kinds of places.
Totally. He made a point of focusing on local stuff, like really local concerns, avoided the national shouting matches.
And framed it as competence.
Right.
Making sure law enforcement was professional, not political.
Exactly. The sense was voters felt the incumbent sheriff was letting national politics seep into local governing. Ciesler promised, basically, competent, non-extreme local leadership.
And it worked. Even though... Doesn't Bucks County still have more registered Republicans?
Oh, yeah, significantly. Like nearly 10,000 more registered Republicans than Democrats. It's a doubled advantage for the GOP on paper.
So for Democrats to win by 10 points.
It means a huge number of registered Republicans or maybe independents who lean Republican crossed over. They specifically chose candidates promising, you know, just common sense local governing over party label. That registration advantage just vanished.
Which brings us to the guy who represents this district in Congress, Republican Brian Fitzpatrick, PA-01. He's like the Houdini of Republicans.
He really is, often called Teflon Fitz. He just keeps outperforming the top of the ticket, survives these blue waves. He's the last Republican standing in the Philly suburbs, a true outlier.
So Democrats see this local sweep. They see Governor Shapiro's popularity, and they think, okay, this is the year we finally get Fitzpatrick.
That's the hope, yeah. They're confident. But the Republicans, they point to his track record. He won by 13 points in 2024, even as Trump barely won the county.
And he raises a ton of money.
A ton, like almost $900,000 last quarter alone. They're not worried, or at least they say they're not.
So his brand is key. He's ranked, what, the most bipartisan member of Congress? Co-chairs the Problem Solvers Caucus?
Right, and he makes sure people know about his breaks with Trump. You know, confirming Biden won in 2020, voting against that big domestic policy bill. He cultivates that distance.
And that helps him defy gravity, as they say.
It seems to. But the Democratic strategy against him next year, it's shaping up to be about tying him to the national party anyway.
The agenda of chaos argument.
Exactly. Saying, okay, maybe you vote against some things, but your party enables extremism and you're still part of that. And then hitting him on cost of living issues, trying to pin that on the GOP broadly.
Arguing his moderate votes ultimately do nothing for people's wallets.
Right. It's going to be fascinating. That district, PA-01, it's like a perfect microcosm of the whole national battleground for 2026.
Okay, so we've talked local politics, stage shifts, but now let's turn to something maybe deeper, more fundamental. This growing rift you mentioned between the Catholic Church and the administration, specifically over migration policy.
Yeah, this isn't just about competing policies. It feels like a clash of, well, core moral frameworks.
How so?
Well, you have the NJA-aligned view on migrants, which is often very harsh, very restrictionist, and that runs directly counter to fundamental Catholic teaching about the dignity of every single human being, the call to love foreigners, refugees.
Basic tenets of the faith.
Exactly. And this isn't just theoretical anymore. It's playing out very practically, very visibly.
What are some of the really stark examples from the source material? The ones that stick with you.
Well, there was that incident in Broadview, Illinois. ICE reportedly denied Catholic priests access to detainees.
Denied access for what?
To bring them the Eucharist.
Yeah.
Communion, which for Catholics is profoundly important. They believe it's the actual body of Christ. Denying that, that's a serious escalation.
Wow. Okay. What else?
We've seen reports of priests and nuns literally accompanying immigrants to their ICE check-ins. Standing with them as a physical presence, hoping to deter, you know, summary deportations right then and there.
Using their presence as a shield, almost.
In a way, yes. And maybe the most dramatic, the Diocese of San Bernardino out in California. They formally released Catholics from their Sunday Mass obligation.
Lifted the obligation to go to Mass. Why?
Specifically to protect them, because people were reportedly being targeted and picked up by ICE agents right as they were leaving church on Sunday morning.
That is astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
Targeted leaving church.
Yeah. So the diocese said, essentially, your safety comes first. You don't have to risk capture to fulfill your religious duty this week.
And this isn't just local priests acting alone. This goes higher up.
Oh, yeah. The late Pope Francis spoke out repeatedly, urging Catholics, don't give in to narratives that discriminate, warning against building walls of ignominy.
Strong language.
Very. And the current pope, Leo XIV, he's been just as forceful, maybe even more direct. He essentially questioned if you can even be pro-life if you support the inhuman treatment of immigrants.
Drawing a direct line between those issues.
Mm-hmm. He said, I don't know if that's pro-life. And he's warned that abusing vulnerable migrants, that constitutes grave crimes committed or tolerated by the state. Heavy stuff.
So how's the administration responding to this moral pressure from the Vatican and the U.S. bishops?
Publicly. Dismissive. The White House reportedly told one journalist pretty bluntly, the Pope doesn't know what he's talking about.
Just outright dismissal.
Yeah. And then you have political figures like Senator J.B. Vance trying to undermine the U.S. bishops' credibility.
Now.
Accusing them of being motivated by money, pointing to the funds they received for refugee resettlement, over $100 million. Trying to frame it as self-interest, not moral principle.
And Vance also used a theological term, right?
Yeah.
Ordo amoris.
Yeah, the order of loves.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to use it to argue it's okay, even right, to prioritize loving Americans over loving immigrants. Kind of a theological justification for nationalism.
But didn't Pope Francis address that exact argument?
He did. Specifically pushed back on that interpretation using the parable of the Good Samaritan, which, yeah, you know, is pretty much the classic Christian teaching against prioritizing care based on nationality or group identity. It teaches universal care.
So it really forces a choice for some people.
It absolutely does. It brings up this fundamental question, especially for Catholic voters, officials, maybe even folks working in immigration enforcement. A question of dual loyalty.
Faith versus state.
Yeah. When your faith's demands about universal human dignity clash head on with an America First ideology, and with how state policy is actually being carried out, which one wins? Which duty comes first? It's a profound conflict. Hashtag tag tag outro. So, pulling it all together, what we're seeing is, I think, pretty clear. On one level, the antidote to some of this national polarization seems to be really local, common sense stuff.
Like in Georgia, Mississippi, Bucks County.
Exactly. Those Democratic wins suggest voters respond to focusing on community, competence, steering clear of the extremes. Those are political shifts, though, tactical wins.
But underneath that?
Underneath, there's this deeper, maybe more significant tremor, this macro level moral clash, like the church versus the administration on migration. That represents a potentially much longer term, maybe more destabilizing kind of fault line.
Which leads us to that final thought, something for you, the listener, to really chew on. Bishop Mark Seitz of El Paso. He suggested Catholics working within the deportation system might soon face a really hard choice.
Yeah, he said they might have to make that difficult moral choice to say, in conscience, I can no longer do this.
So the question for all of us then is, what does it actually mean for American stability, for the fabric of society, when deeply held religious duties, moral imperatives, start lining up against the stated goals, the actual enforcement of the law of the land?
When people feel forced to choose between their faith and their government, what happens next?
A powerful question to end on. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material.
We'll see you next time.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.